longtime friend of Missouri agriculture, longtime leader in Missouri and the nation, our Senator Roy Blunt. Please help me welcome him today.
Well, thank you, Blake. It's great to be here, and thanks for the early endorsement from Farm Bureau outside the normal way things are done so that Blake could spend that time with me in March and April and May and June and July. And we'll be with some of you officially at the State Fair with the event that you host that I get a chance to be part of to talk about agriculture. Is Pat Roberts still scheduled to come in? And the chairman of the Ag Committee is coming in that day to be with us as well. But Blake and I were traveling. Charlie Cruz was with us. He and Chris Chen, right there under the banner in the middle of the back of the room, are our co-chairmen of our Ag Committee. And many of you are on that. And I think all of you know how much time I spend not just thinking about agriculture, but talking about agriculture. I really believe what's about to happen here is the biggest economic driver that anybody has seen, maybe ever, certainly in a long time. You know, world food demand doubling in one working lifetime. 35 or 40 years from now, the biggest area of commerce in the world will be twice as big as it is today. And nobody is in a better position than we are as a country to take advantage of that. But particularly where nobody's in a better position than we are where we live to take advantage of that. A lot of you have heard me say this before, but you know, the Mississippi River Valley is the biggest piece of contiguous agricultural ground in the world, has the best farmers and ranchers in the world, the best ag research institutions, public and private, in the world, and the best way to get things all over the world of anywhere in the world. The Mississippi River, about to be more important than it's been in 100 years, and those of us who care about competition and agriculture also ought to be thinking about the challenges of a time when, you know, what it's taken thousands of years to get to do is going to double in one working lifetime. There'll be years when this doesn't work out exactly like we would want it to. There'll be years when we're a little ahead of the challenge instead of a little behind. And who wins that competition are the people who have the most cost-effective and efficient way to compete in that world economy. And there's every reason to believe we would have that. But all of us should be encouraging the Missouri legislature to be thinking about a transportation system that works competitively. You know, the Mississippi River is a great thing if you get to it and you can get on it. But if you get to it and there's nothing there, no way to get on it, it's not an opportunity, it's an obstacle. So this is the time we ought to be thinking about how we make our obstacles into opportunities. And I guarantee you, 10 years from now and 15 years from now, people will be thinking either, boy, it's a good thing we saw that coming and got ready for it, or they'll be thinking, why did we let those markets that were so naturally ours go to Canada and Brazil and Argentina and Australia? Why did we let that happen? You know, it's sort of like more American energy. The great opportunity there is largely be dealt away from us by our own government. And so Abby and I have been on the bus, the campaign bus this week. I'll be 100 stops in Missouri in August talking about more jobs and less government. The biggest single obstacle to economic opportunity in America today are government regulators who are totally out of control. And I'm for a presidential candidate who will sign a bill that would make me vote on every regulation that has any economic consequence. And by the way, if you're wondering, there's only one of the two candidates who would do that. Just like there's only one of the two candidates that will get this disastrous Obamacare thing headed in a different direction or help come up with a foreign policy where our friends trust us again and our enemies are afraid of us again. We've gotten ourselves into a situation now where our friends don't trust us and our enemies aren't afraid of us in an unbelievably dangerous world. But let's not forget jobs, opportunity, and regulators here for a minute. And you all know this story as well as I do, and you live with it every day, and you think about the consequences of what would happen if the EPA actually got the ability to control every drop of water in the country. You know, we put this bill on the president's desk to not do this. And this has been debated in the Senate 3 times, but I've talked about it a lot more than the days it was officially debated. And on the waters of the U.S., every time I've talked about that, in the last year, I've had the Farm Bureau map over my shoulder that only the part is colored in red, which would be under the jurisdiction of the EPA if they got their way with waters of the U.S. But since the part that's colored in red is 99.7% of the state, you got to get really close to find, I guess, the sinkholes. We must be 0.3% sinkholes, because that's the only part that they wouldn't argue they have jurisdiction over. You know, if you want to really slow down the economy, and particularly the opportunity to compete, make the EPA have to approve every building permit, every utility pole hole to be dug, what fertilizer you put on your field, and even whether the county commission could mow the right-of-ways or not. Because every roadside ditch in every one of your counties would be navigable water if the EPA gets its way. And well, you know, that's a very good point. And I understand the frustration there, because I have it more than you do. With most presidents, taking the money away from them would have made a difference and some things would have been done. The EPA has fewer employees than any time since 1987. We take more money away from them every single time, but of course that also makes it harder for the things that they've already got their hands on to get anything done. He just really doesn't care. There are fewer employees at the IRS than there were 10 years ago. And that, those kinds of things would normally work. You know, and by the way, you're all my friends. You're helpful to me in unbelievable ways. I guarantee you, if you knew what I was doing, rather than what you think, what your neighbors think I might have been doing, I'd be a whole lot more popular. Because I fight these rules and regulations all the time. I'm always looking for ways to get their attention. And by the way, no better way to get their attention recently than President Obama in the last year of his presidency will not get a lifetime nominee on the Supreme Court. Now you hear all this nonsense about, oh, the history of this. The history of this is exactly in line with what we're doing. The last time somebody got a vacancy filled on the Supreme Court that occurred during a presidential election year was 1932. The last time anybody got a vacancy filled on the Supreme Court that occurred in a presidential election year, if the Senate was controlled by a different party than the president, was 1888. People need to be heard. And this, the court matters. If there's no other reason for a Republican president and a Republican Senate, the court is the reason. Now, if there's a Democrat Senate, if I don't win this race, we will not be in the majority in the Senate. I'm pretty sure of that. You know, we're going to work hard, but it's very possible that you and I, in our efforts here, are sending the 51st Republican senator to the Senate. Be unbelievable if it was more than the 52nd Republican senator to the Senate. This is a closely held moment, and the court matters, even if, God forbid, Mrs. Clinton gets elected. Because the first thing the Democrats will do if she's elected and they get a majority in the Senate is they'll change the last rule that they hadn't changed already, which is means the Supreme Court would also take 51 votes. At least if it still takes 60 votes, I can't imagine that I would vote for a Hillary Clinton nominee to the court, but you can't put one on there if we're in control with less than 60 people voting for it, and that will matter. And these court cases matter. You know, we just had, the court just dealt with the executive amnesty, which I was absolutely and totally opposed to, and I never voted to provide that money either. Executive amnesty, fortunately, the federal courts stopped it from happening, but that's the kind of thing that the Supreme Court now gets to decide. Executive amnesty, they've got a case, Josh Hawley's gonna be here later. He and I were both pretty involved in this HHS mandate on telling employers what kind of insurance you had to provide, even if you were a religious institution. You know, they just failed to decide on a case because they said, surely you can do better than this to the federal government, where this group called the Little Sisters of the Poor are being told by the federal government that they have to have health insurance that violates their faith principles. Now, the Little Sisters of the Poor, the organizational statement for the Little Sisters of the Poor is that we will receive older people who have no resources, regardless of their faith, as if they are Jesus Christ. Now, it doesn't sound like that's a group that the federal government would have to crack down on. Would the federal government be, would the country be inexorably and forever damaged if the Little Sisters of the Poor are allowed to have health insurance that meets their faith principles? Of course not. But would we be irreparably damaged and different than who we've always been if we say, doesn't matter whether it impacts anybody else or not, we're going to make you do something that violates your faith? We would never be who we are again if we begin to let that happen. There is a reason that freedom of religion is the first thing mentioned in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And there's a reason that the Second Amendment is there as well. And in the Senate race, by the way, I have an A from the NRA. My son Matt, somebody asked about Matt earlier, Matt's on the NRA board. Jason Kander has an F. Most places you are, that will be about all you need to say. Because it doesn't just say something about the Second Amendment, it says something about all the amendments. It says something about all our freedom. And we have a great opportunity out here. I think the regulators have been so terrible, the federal government so dysfunctional, that it's been hard to just look up. This opportunity is not beyond the horizon, it's this side of the horizon. When I see these FFA kids here or in Washington, either one, in their blue jackets or their FFA shirts, and I say, look, just imagine if you decide to pursue food, what you're talking about now in your career, whether it's production agriculture, food processing, food marketing, transportation, commodity trading, the day you leave that job, twice as much will be happening in what you've decided to do as the day you started. And I can't think of another single thing you could have ever made that certain a prediction. It would take something cataclysmic for this not to happen. We need to be sure that we're benefiting from it in every way. And we also need to be sure we don't lose who we are. I was at Marshfield High School the other day. First job after college. First person in my family that ever got a job that you had to have a college degree to have. Because I was the first person in my family that ever had a college degree. So it was a place I taught high school history. Marshfield High School. It was the 100th anniversary of the building. I did not teach there when it was new. 100th anniversary of the building. And I was thinking about my connections with that building as I was going to speak at this 100th anniversary of the building. My grandfather, who's a farmer, but you know, when he, a retired farmer, has to work, at least my grandfather did. He was the janitor at that building. It was his last job. Now, in most countries, that would be an unbelievable story. So let me see if I got this straight again. Your grandfather was the janitor. Your parents were dairy farmers. You were a high school history teacher, and you became a United States senator. But in this country, there are, maybe there are not thousands of stories just like that in the Senate, but there are millions of stories like that as to who we are. And we cannot lose who we are. That's what this fight is about. That's what this election is about. In Missouri, we need to have our legislators and our state officials headed toward a more common purpose than they have been. But that's what this is about. So Charlie Blunt, the other day, went to 2 weeks of sleepover camp at Lesterville, at Camp Tom Salk. And by the way, Charlie's first note back to us was, I don't mean to seem greedy, but could you send some packages? Second sentence was, I got bit by a snake yesterday. Third sentence was, I just got bit by a wasp. Fourth sentence was, I'm having a good time. Love, Charlie. I've told that to a couple of people here in the day after the day, couple days after the primary. The snake bite's over, the wasp bite's over, time to move on. But Tony Harbison, as we were driving through Ironton to take Charlie to camp at Lesterville, Abby Blunt said, "You know, my favorite story from the last time you ran for the Senate was the Tony Harbison story." And the Tony Harbison story was, Tony and I were standing outside the Iron County Courthouse one day in late 2009 after the best piece of coconut cream pie I'd ever eaten that his niece made. And Tony was talking about what he did, you know, farmer, but mostly a tree trimmer. And he said, "When I like to leave somebody's property, I like it to look like nobody's been there except the trees look better. So we pick up every limb, we pick up every leaf. If there's a rut that we've made in somebody's yard, we roll the rut in the yard." And he said, "My boys, one by one, who always had to help me, and you know, my mom and dad were dairy farmers, so I quickly got the whole involuntary servitude thing." He said, my boys, who've always had to help me, one by one, they would say, "Dad, why do we do it this way? Nobody else does it this way." And he said, "Every time they said that, I said, if you do it like everybody else does it, you're just everybody else." The United States of America is not just everybody else. I don't care what the current president says. And we don't want to be just like everybody else. Let us be who we are. Let us have a country where the people are bigger than the government. Let us have a country where the janitor's grandson can become the United States Senator. Let's have a country where we're looking all the time, not just for how we have better jobs next year, which is the most important criteria, but what are we doing that's going to see that we take advantage of this opportunity that's clearly down the road so that they just get better and better all the time. People are tired of being told by the government and people better off than them what's good for them, only to find out it doesn't turn out to be so good for us. It's an important fight. It's a wonderful fight. It's a great country. I'm so honored to get to work for you and to have your help. November the 9th, no chance to go back and say I should have done just a little bit more. I never heard a single person after an election say, "I wish I hadn't worked as hard as I did." 95 or so days, and it will determine a lot about who we are for a long time. Thank you all.
Thank you, Senator, for what you do in Washington, what you do here in Missouri, and for being with us today. So thank you very, very much.